Good? Yes? Hey, hopefully everybody can hear me okay. Yes? In the back? Sort of? Head nods? Okay. So my name's Scott Dickens. We're going to spend the next sort of 75 minutes or so together talking about Metro-style apps, specifically those built in HTML5. And so I kind of wanted to give you a little bit of background and history about myself. So I am an accidental computer scientist. I did not get into computer science, you know, to start with, because like I knew I wanted to go that route. I sort of lucked into it. And so I went to business school. And when you're at business school, you need to choose a concentration. And many people choose like finance and accounting and marketing, et cetera. And I didn't really think those were too interesting. And so they had this program. It was called Information Science, which was sort of computer-based. And so I said, you know, I play computer games. How hard can this computer stuff be? And so that's sort of how I got involved in computers to start with. And my first class was this ISDS class, this information systems class. And we were asked to design a web page. And so this is the mid-90s. This is 1996. And so as part of building that web page, we put together a little tutorial because we said, hey, the web is still new. Other people might need to know how to build a web page. And so this is that tutorial, if you will. And it describes, it tells other people how to build a web page. And so quick test, what's the one thing that's wrong with this page? Anybody, the one thing? No, you guys failed. There's way more than one thing wrong with this page. There's Java applets. There's animated GIFs. There's like this frame style page navigation. This is like completely like Web 1.0, Web 0.5, if you will. This is like 1995 era. And so the reason that I bring this up is because, one, I'll help establish some rapport with existing web developers. But really, most importantly, it's that you can build really, really powerful, okay, this isn't super powerful, but very, very powerful things using web technologies. And you can build really, really good things or really, really bad things. And so part of my talk today is to put you guys on the right path and sort of show you the tips and tricks and the knowledge that you need in order to build very, very powerful Metro-style apps in HTML5 sort of the right way. And so let's quickly jump in, and I'll kind of describe and show you guys some stuff, because the Metro stuff looks pretty. And so maybe to start with, let's look at an existing website. So this is Bing's finance website. Very, very typical of websites today, like, yeah, white background, et cetera, et cetera. But the topography, the layout of the page, the fact that it scrolls vertically versus horizontally, you can see, like, there's controls, and it's meant to be interacted with a mouse and keyboard. And, like, I'd like to check. So I have touch feedback turned on. That's what this little thing is. And so, yeah, I want to check on Microsoft stock. And I can do that and get quotes. And you can see the page sort of navigates. You could see there was a flash. If I had sound hooked up, there would have been that audible click, like tick, as the page navigated. Like very, very typical of a website today. And so let's take a look at an app. And so the Bing.com finance app is one of the apps that are free in the Windows Store right now. And for those that have not already downloaded the software, please do so. You can go to Microsoft.com/Windows and get linked to download the Windows 8 release preview. And so you could get the same build that I'm running right now along with all the apps, along with the dev tools. And so this is sort of the app version. You can see that it emphasizes content over Chrome. Like every pixel on the screen is owned and drawn by the app. There was no browser Chrome sort of around it. You can see that I sort of scroll horizontally instead of vertically in the page. Other things like common tasks like, hey, I might want to look and see stock quotes. I can do that. But I do that through Windows integration points like the search contract. And so this is always kind of fun. Hopefully nobody has Facebook stock in the room. Sorry about that. I actually kind of like this view better. The one-year view. It's getting there. Hopefully it'll come back. So anyway, just sort of an intro to sort of that design pattern and the new focus between building websites and building a Windows 8 Metro-style app using your web skills. And so this talk is really about that latter thing. Let me switch back over to get the hang of this thing. And so we're going to talk about five things today. And I talked to a few of you guys before I got started. So web developers, if you're an existing web developer in the room, you're going to be happy because we're going to show lots of web code. But this session really isn't about teaching you how to be a web developer. I'm not going to teach you how to do JavaScript or CSS or HTML. I feel like the SDK samples are the right things for that, and those exist on MSDN right now. Similarly, if you're an IT person, you may not be as happy with my session, because again, we're going to show a lot of details about building apps, which means showing code and showing stuff in Visual Studio. So if you're an IT person, sort of bear with me, because I think I'll give you sort of an overview of how your devs in your environment are going to go about building these apps and things that you might need to know to help support them. So just trying to give you guys a sense of where we're going with this particular talk. But we're going to talk about five things. The first three sort of as a group. And then we'll talk about process lifecycle. And then last, we'll finish up with a quick discussion about enterprise features, some particular features to the app model that may be interesting to you guys if you're looking to build enterprise-based apps. So like I said, the first three, let's just kind of talk together as a group. And we'll do our best to stay out of PowerPoint and over like on the demo machine. So these are kind of just a couple of quick slides. The first thing is this concept of my app. And I talked to a gentleman right before this talk started, and he's like, I'm an existing ASP.NET developer. Help me rationalize what ASP.NET means and what we're going to talk about in this talk. And so I sort of picture ASP.NET as being a power engine, like a back-end technology type thing, even though it generates HTML and CSS and JavaScript client-side pages. But the talk that we're going through today and these apps that you're going to build, these are client apps, which basically means that much of the code, if not almost all of the code, lives on the client. And the way that it gets to clients is this entity called a package. And so if you're thinking about how you do web development today, you write a bunch of code and you publish it to some IIS server or other such server, and then clients interact with that website and download the code and then runs in a browser. And what we're talking about here is that you as an app developer are going to write some HTML and CSS and JavaScript. We're going to take that thing and bundle it into a package, and then that package is going to move to the client machine. And so let's kind of go through what that package looks like. So you get a set of free tools. You can use the Visual Studio Ultimate as well. But there's a set of free tools that you get to go build Metro-style apps. And so that's what I'm showing right now. This is just Visual Studio Express. You can download the tools when you download the build. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise, like the first thing that we're going to do, new project, right? And there's a set of templates here for JavaScript-based apps. We'll just choose a blank one and click OK. So now we have our most basic app possible. And I want to call out a couple of things here on the right-hand pane. And this is sort of the anatomy of our application, if you will. And there's some things that you'll recognize. Like, there's an HTML file. In that HTML file, there's not really much code right now, but like this is the landing spot of your app. There's a folder for CSS files, and in that is some default CSS. And of course, we could add more. Like, this should all look very, very natural to you guys. And then there's a JavaScript file with a default JS, et cetera. So your HTML, your CSS, your JavaScript, and even resources, like if you wanted to create a folder and put all of your PNGs in that particular folder, all of those things sort of encompass your app. And you would do that here in Visual Studio. And then the thing that really describes your package is this thing called a package manifest. And this is sort of the manifest designer that you see in the left-hand pane. And so it includes a couple of things that are sort of common, like, hey, there's a display name for your app. If you don't want to call it App 1, you want to call it Scott's App, this is where you do that. And like the start page, this is like, was this index.html? Was this default.html? You would choose those things. And then you could choose description. But the manifest is really there for two purposes. One is a deployment-related purpose. The other is a runtime-related purpose. The deployment-related purpose is something that's super beneficial to you guys looking to build apps. And that's that you don't have to think about how your app gets onto a client machine. And you don't have to spend time writing an installer, which is something very different for sort of client devs, right? Like, today you go and build an MSI, and that's how you get your package onto client machines, or you build some install script. Like, none of that exists. Like, you author this manifest file, and Visual Studio gives you this you know, designer to do that, and then that helps you deploy the app to the machine. Windows handles all of that. Then the second part is runtime stuff, and that's this capabilities tab, and we're going to return to the capabilities tab sort of later in the talk. And it shouldn't come as a big surprise, but basically the manifest file is really nothing more than an XML file. And so there's a pretty designer that you could use to input the fields, or you could just go to view code and then edit the XML yourself. And so let's take a deeper look at this package. There's a store menu here. And I call this out because the natural and most familiar way that users will know to get apps is to go to the Windows Store. You should think of that as like most Metro apps come from the Windows Store. But there are two other ways that clients can get apps, and that's what you as developers are very interested in. The first is that, clearly, as a developer, I should be able to run an app. And I should be able to go to my friend developer and go, please run this app. And he should be able to go to his friend developer and go, please run this app. And so there is a way to, quote unquote, sideload apps. And so that's what we're really talking about here. As a developer, I have a way to load apps. And then the third way is that as an enterprise, I have a way to load apps not from the store. Now, the caveat to all of this is that all applications, all of these packages, if you will, are signed, meaning they're signed by somebody's certificate. And the client needs to trust that certificate in order to install the app. So if the app comes from the App Store, all Windows 8 machines trust the cert of the App Store, thus they can all get apps from the App Store. If you're a dev, you will get a license. And the first time that you install Visual Studio, you'll enter in some credentials, and now you have a dev license, and that comes with a cert that signs your package. And then if you're an enterprise, then the idea is that you would sign your apps with your enterprise cert, and then all of your client machines would also trust that cert. And so that's a way to deploy in the enterprise. So here we are at the store menu, and we're going to create an app package. We're not going to upload it to the Windows Store because we're just going to test it out right now on our local machine. Please help me remember this path. It'll come in later. And then the last thing, I'm just kidding on the path thing, by the way. It was like a memorization exercise. Everybody's like, I don't know if I can do it. And then the last thing that you should see on this screen is like, hey, what's the architecture of this app? We're web devs. Like, what do we know about architecture? Like, our code is really like text files. And those text files get interpreted and compiled, if you will, at runtime. And so we're not building an x86 executable. We're not building an ARM executable. We're just building a package that has a set of files in it, and those are just web files. And so we'll create this package. And again, see, Visual Studio does the right thing. I don't have to remember the path. And we'll take a look at the output here. So there's a folder. In the folder is the interesting stuff. There's my package itself. And this contained all of the HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And there's a couple other things here, the cert that's used to sign that particular package, and then a PowerShell script, which you would use to install the package outside of the store. So you as devs, now you know how to build your first package and how to distribute it. Like, hey, fellow dev, go take the contents of this folder and then run that PowerShell script, and poof, now you have that particular app. And so let's take a closer look at the package. The package itself is really just a zip file. And so if we rename it to .zip, then we can go into it in Windows Explorer. And so I'll try to put these up sort of side by side here so we can see them. And what you should see is that it's essentially the same structure that you had in Visual Studio, right? Like, there's this default HTML file. OK, I got default HTML. Got it. And then there's like this CSS folder with default CSS. OK, got it. And then there's like the JS folder with default JS. OK, got it. So think of it as you're building your app. Everything that you're including there in Visual Studio, all your HTML, all your CSS, all your JavaScript, bundled up into this package. The package moves to the client machine. Windows does the installation for you. Now your code is on the client. Congratulations, you've written your first app in HTML5. So that's sort of the overview, high level overview of the package and sort of its components. So let's take a look at the next piece. So I mentioned that these files themselves are not like an .exe. You saw the package. It was just HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And so your natural next question would be, OK, how do these things run? And so like, I understand how this runs in a browser today, but what is really powering these Metro-style apps in HTML5? Well, it turns out it's a web platform. And that web platform is shared with Internet Explorer 10. And so the same set of capabilities that are in Internet Explorer 10 power this particular Metro-style apps in HTML5. And there are a couple of differences. And so we might as well show them. I think it'll be easier to show them than talk to them. Let me stop debugging this thing and we'll create. So maybe the easiest way to do this is just pull up a browser. So here's a browser. You know, pick your favorite browser. But they basically have two components to them, two major components. The first is what we'll call the frame, and the second is what we'll call the tab. So the frame is the part of the browser that you typically interact with at the top. Like, it's the thing that's powering this back and forward button. It's the thing that gives you the address bar. You have tabs. You can create more tabs, et cetera. You have favorites. These are all browser-like functionality that's in the frame of a web browser. And then you have the tab itself. And I can kind of hide this a little bit, like if I can get this going here, by going sort of full screen in my browser. And eventually, this may disappear. Yeah. And so now I have this tab. And it is just one tab, but I can get the tabs back. But really, like the engine that displays your website as it exists today, or web content as it exists today, is found in the tab. And that's the thing that interprets HTML, CSS, JavaScript, draws stuff to the screen, has a layout engine, has a display and rendering capabilities, et cetera, et cetera. That's the HTML5 compliant thing. Think of it as if we ripped that component out of Internet Explorer 10, and we built a new host on top of it, and that's the thing that powers Metro-style apps. And so as you're developing these apps, as a web developer, some common things. Hey, does the user have tabs? No, the user doesn't have tabs. Like, we just took one of those tabs. Like, they don't have extra tabs. Do they get an address bar? No. Do they get a back button? No, none of those things. And so let's go back, and I'll show this in action in an app. Like, again, full screen, the app owns every pixel, no address bar, no back button, no favorites, no in-private browsing, no any of those other browser features. They don't exist. But you should notice a couple of other things. Like, this is a single window. It's very common on the web today to like have multiple windows and post message between the windows. And you know, the users have pop-up blockers, and you have to figure out how to go around the pop-up blockers and all that other stuff. One window, only a single window to manage as a web developer. And some other things. This is plug-in free, which is sort of our fancy way of saying that you don't get Silverlight in your app. You don't get Flash in your app. It's just HTML5, the latest web standards. But on the plus side, as web devs, like, who here in this room has had to design a website and goes, I wonder how many of my client machines are going to have IE6 on them or IE7? And how do I make it work in Chrome 3 and Firefox 3 and Safari 3 and IE maybe even 3? And so you don't need to worry about this here, because there is only one document mode, if you will, and that's the latest IE10 standards mode. There's no legacy. It's only the latest stuff. And the second is that you can guarantee that all Windows 8 machines have this capability, because the host is part of the OS. And so you don't have to worry about, oh, does this Windows 8 machine have Firefox on it? Does this one? No. Like, they all get the standard set of capabilities. And it's the highest level of capabilities that are available right now. And so as a web developer, that's total goodness for us. We can just target the features that we want. There's none of this sort of lowest common denominator development where we like build things and then like figure out how to use extra JavaScript libraries so that we can still use Canvas and things like that. Of course we can use Canvas. Of course we can use IndexedDB. Of course we can use AppCache. Of course we can use all of these HTML5 capabilities because they're built into the platform. So let's do another really web dev-y exercise here, if I can take this out of full screen. I'm sure you guys have never done this before, but we're going to go copy somebody else's code. So I'm going to go to the IE test drive site. This looks like a nice demo. It kind of does HTML 5e things, right? This is like the IE team's test drive site. They show off cool platform features. So we're going to steal their code. Let's see here. If I can figure out how to get out of full screen mode. Yeah, on this keyboard, there's like 12 buttons. We'll see if we can do this. I know. The thing that we really want to do. Is we'll do it the hard way. Ta-da! Okay, so this is their code. You can see that it basically has it has some divs, etc., and then it has this big canvas tag, and then some JavaScript, and it powers the whole thing. So let's just do this. We're going to take all of their code from body on down, and we'll just copy it. And this is our blank Visual Studio project or whatever. So all their body, the stuff that was in the body, gone. So we'll take that. They had some JavaScript here at the bottom. These were just links to some navigation stuff, and it was like, this is the link for the IE test drive site. So we don't need that. They clearly have a bunch of JavaScript that's powering this sample, if you will. And so we're going to go steal that, and we're going to put it in the JS folder of our app. And so here in Visual Studio, it's super easy to add new items and existing items. We're going to add a new JavaScript file called demo.js. Here's a little neat trick if you haven't done this before. This, I think I angered it. We'll just pull it up again. Yay. So here's a neat trick if you haven't done this before. You can navigate right to the JS file. This is pretty ugly, but if you pull up the DevTools, just F12 in the browser, you can go to the script tab, and then it looks much more pretty. So we'll just copy all of that script out. There was also a CSS file. I don't know if you guys saw that. So we'll add a new CSS file to this particular so that it looks styled. And we'll call that demo. And again, just creating a new CSS file. There's a style sheet. And again, just stealing the website's code. Great, those are all their styles. And we'll take out these lines at the top. And then there was one last little fix up here, as long as we're stealing code from somebody else. They had some images, so we'll grab those images. This is where existing items comes in handy. Again, just grabbing their images from their website. And we put those in the images folder. So we'll copy those, copy those, copy that. And assuming I didn't do any typos here, like literally on stage in like 2 minutes, I grabbed some website's code, random website code, put it into my MetroStyle app, and now I have the MetroStyle version of this IE test drive site. And so, like, the message to you as web developers is that, yes, by all means, copy code. Take your existing code and move it over. Yes, do that. Like, there's no magic tricks here with the platform. We didn't, like, preface everything with this dash MS to break all of the existing patterns that you already know. All the patterns that you know just work. Bring them over and use that. But as part of that, just like at the beginning where I showed you sort of the not good website and a good website, and then we showed sort of a good app, Like, you can create a not good app, and this is sort of already a not good app. Like, I brought over code, but it doesn't do all the things that we expect apps to do. And so it's not the end. Like it's one part of the process to moving over to building a Metro-style app. So bring that code over, but just know there's more to it than just that that powers your app. And so we'll get into what that means. Switch back over. The last thing that I wanted to mention real quickly about the web platform, and this is in the slide deck that'll be posted, so you guys can have this link. You don't have to write it down right now. Is that a very, very common question is like, I have this web property, foo.com. How do I move that to a Metro-style app? Give me the step-by-step instructions. And so there's a paper online that sort of goes through that. And it gives you the design guidance and the philosophy as well as sort of steps that you would go through to do that, if you so desired to do that. Again, think of the difference between the Bing.com finance website and the Bing finance app that I showed. Lots of differences. So we kind of covered the packages and the app model. We covered the web platform. So let's get into this thing that people are calling WinRT or the Windows runtime. And so it probably would have been really cool if we had said you could build Metro-style apps in HTML5 and we just stopped with everything that I showed you right now. But the stuff that I'm about to show you is really the piece that starts to make your app an app. Because think about it today, like one of the major hurdles we have as web developers is that we have this browser sandbox and we can't break out of that. And that's why we use things like Silverlight and other ActiveX plugins to get at that richer Win32 API surface. And so the idea behind the Windows runtime is to take the set of APIs that you need in order to build a Metro-style app and then promote those so that you can call them directly from JavaScript in a natural and familiar way. So you're not writing C# code, though you could if you wanted. You're not writing C++ code, though again you could if you wanted. You're just writing JavaScript code that calls Windows APIs outright. And that's what the Windows runtime is all about. And so it gives you access to things like the file system. It gives you access to contracts like you saw in the keynote demos, like search and share, those kind of contracty type things. It gives you access to devices. It gives you access to a bunch more. And so let's take a closer look at sort of the Windows runtime. By the way, is the pace okay? Too fast? Too slow? Okay. So let's stop debugging this, and I'll show you a different project. So there are a ton of SDK samples, again, online at MSDN. I'm just using one of those, file picker sample, because I hate it when I go to sessions and like people show me code and I can never reproduce that code. It's like mystery code. So like this is just an SDK sample. I have not modified it in any way, shape, or form, which sort of means that it can be a little boring. But again, like you can directly reuse this code. And so here we are in this file picker. And so let me set the stage on the file picker a little bit. You know how you're in OWA and you're like composing a mail, or you're in Gmail and you're composing a mail, and you click like add attachment, and then this like Windows dialog comes up, and that's where you pick your file? That's what the picker is. It's just the Metro version of that. And so it's full screen and touch friendly and all that other stuff, but it sort of serves that same purpose. So we're going to use this thing, and it says, hey, pick a single photo. So I pick a photo. Probably don't want this photo. I'll pick this photo. This is nicer. I click open. I had already set a breakpoint in this project, and so that's why we're broken in the debugger. As long as we're here, I might as well teach you a couple things about using the debugger. So this is the console or immediate window. You can issue JavaScript commands directly from here. So this is how you debug your app. Hey, everybody knows there's this window object. This should be very familiar for you guys, debugging web code. And off of it is like all the usual suspects that you would expect to see off the window object. But there is this other object called Windows with a capital W. This is the Windows runtime namespace. This is where all the Windows runtime goo lives. And so in it, you can see, wow, I have this really rich namespace with application model, data, graphics, media, all of these other capabilities that are way outside the normal DOM capabilities of your browser. This is the Windows runtime. And in that, like, we can drill in lots and lots and lots of APIs. Again, MSDN is sort of your reference for that. So let's take a look at the code above and see what it's doing. I'm trying to make it a little bigger here so everybody can see. And so sort of we started with, if I can get it to highlight, we knew up a file open picker. And so you should, like, the syntax that you see here is the exact same stuff that you would be doing on the web. The namespace is different. That's it. So we get this file open picker. We methods and events on that file open picker we use to configure things like, hey, I only want to see thumbnails. I don't want to see a list or details, but I could. And like, where do you want it to start? OK, I want it to start in the pictures library. OK, that makes sense, because I'm going to go pick a picture. And then like, hey, I want to filter files. Like, only show me PNGs and JPEGs, et cetera. And so you use all these methods. And this is very common. Like, new up an instance of this Windows Runtime class, configure it how you want it, use it. Again, all through JavaScript. Like, there's no C# or C++ code here. You're just directly calling this. And the power is file open picker is implemented as a C++ DLL that Windows owns. So you're calling this native API directly from JavaScript. So let's take a closer look at this and just see, like, now that you guys know what the sample does and the configuration. Again, pick a single photo, on button click, new up an instance of this. File open picker. Again, thumbnails, picture library, only returning PNGs, JPEGs, etc. So sort of very common Windows runtimey pattern. Kind of switch back. So we spent that example sort of talking about local data. But as web devs, we know we actually don't interact very much with local data at all. It's all about web services, dynamic data from the cloud, if you will. And this includes everything from sort of RSS, JSON feeds, et cetera, XHR, like all of those types of patterns. And so as web devs, I wanted to kind of discuss how you should think about those. On the web today, we have this notion of site of origin. And that's sort of the boundary, if you will, of our app in many ways. And then when we go outside of that site of origin, special rules apply in order to get extra data, et cetera. So your app's contents, the HTML, the CSS, the JavaScript of your app, the things that exist, the files that exist, the code that exists in the package itself, we call that stuff local context. That's trusted code. That's code that you, as the developer, you wrote that. And in that particular trusted context, you get to do new things. You get to call the Windows runtime from code that lives in that context. But it's also very, very, very common for you to want to get at code, resources, et cetera, that are not in your package. Like, best example that I have right now, like, you want to use a mashup. Like, I want Bing Maps or I want Google Maps or whatever as part of my app. How do I do that? And today, the way that you do that is like http://, and you reference their particular thing, and then you make a bunch of calls to their API. And that's all via HTTP, and that's not going to change. Like, we're not asking Google to say, please give us a new API set for Metro apps. We're not doing that. And so all of the patterns that you would expect as a web developer continue to hold and be true. The difference being untrusted code, code that you didn't write, but somebody else wrote, we don't let that call the Windows runtime. For the same reasons the browser doesn't let that happen today. It's untrusted code. Like, they could be doing something malicious, and like, we don't want that to happen. And so we have segmented local context and web context. Local context, code in your package, trusted code gets to call the Windows runtime. Web context, untrusted code does not get to call the Windows runtime. And you talk between the two using HTML5's post message, which is just an easy way to sort of send messages in between frames. And so how do you know whether you're in the local context or the web context? Might as well look at a quick demo and we can show that. Again, just like I showed an SDK sample before, I'll show another one. This one is called the Mashup SDK sample. So you can go grab this online. And then we'll run it. Yeah. So the first of this, there's a bunch of different scenarios that you can select in the mashup example. We're going to start with this web context versus local context, because that's what we're talking about right now. So this sample basically has two iframes. The first iframe is a page loaded from MS-APEX. That is the protocol that our host uses to get at the contents of your package. Just like we use HTTP to go to the web, we use MS-APEX to go local. And then the third dash slash, that's not a typo. That's just an alias to your package. Because your package is given this long GUID identifier, and we're not asking you as web devs to remember that thing. And so the third slash is the alias to your package, and then we've loaded this file called callwinrt.htm. And in fact, in the project, you can see, like, okay, here's callwinrt.htm. Okay, got it. And so when I make a call to the Windows Runtime API, so it's going to call windows.applicationModel.package, an API there, like, and I'm making it, and the source of my iframe, or the main page, is from MS-APEX, you can see that the call succeeds, and I get back legitimate data. But if I try to make that same call from a web context, and here there's a little advanced magic in the SDK sample. There are two different ways that you can get a web context. One is by doing iframe source equals HTTP colon whatever. Now you're in the web context. The other is do iframe source equals MS-APEX web for web context. And now I can reference local packaged content as the web context. And so that's what this sample does. It's some advanced magic to do that. And then when I try to use that same Windows Runtime API, the entire Windows with a capital W namespace does not exist. It's not defined. And I get an exception. So everybody see that? From the local context, I can call WinRT APIs. It's trusted. From the web context, I cannot call WinRT APIs. It's not trusted. And so you might say, like, how do I get into these situations? Like, it seems like I wouldn't be doing this naturally. And again, that's sort of why we show the Bing or Google Maps, et cetera, example. Because, like, the way that service works in apps is it says, please take this HTML file and load that HTML file. So you package up this HTML file as part of your app. You load that thing, and then that thing says, script, source equals, www.bing.com/whatever/whatever. Source equals www.bing.com whatever. And so it wants to grab a bunch of dynamic script from the web to power that particular map. And that's exactly the script that we don't want calling the Windows Runtime APIs. And so the way that you do this in your app is you'd have local context main page, and then an iframe that's loading the maps page from the web context. And then in the web context, all of its normal rules apply. In the local context, it gets to call WinRT APIs. And then you post message in between the two to communicate for things like push pins and other stuff like that. So very, very common example. I bring this up because it's naturally one of the first things that you're going to hit as you start to build more interesting apps. Another thing, and so here's sort of the in the SDK sample, there's like the okay, show me how post message works. Okay, this is how post message works between the different frames. So you can see that. The last thing that I want to mention really quickly is about adding dynamic HTML. And so here's a very, very common pattern. I talk to some web service using XHR. I get back some goo. And I go, hey, use inner HTML. And I insert it into the DOM. Like, happens all the time. I think I'm getting back some XML. I use inner HTML. I put it into the DOM. Well, we want to keep you safe as web developers. And so we're not asking you to go inspect the contents that you're getting and putting into the DOM using inner HTML. But we are doing some magic under the covers to make sure that you don't insert script accidentally doing that. And so it's very common. Like, if you're using the jQuery library and doing XHR or whatever, like, you'll probably hit this very quickly. It's like, hey, I used jQuery. I tried to do XHR. Grab some goo. Used inner HTML. Bang, exception happened. And what probably happened was that you tried to inject content that had script in it, and that was ripped out. And so this example sort of shows what that looks like. Like, here's a div with an onClick handler, which is the script part. And so, like, when you try to do that from these are different scenarios, it'll tell you, like, hey, here's what happens. Like, when you try to do this from your local context, and you try to use inner HTML, and this was the string, bang, you got a JS exception. It was thrown, because it said, hey, I just wanted to let you know, like, you thought you were getting XML, but really, you had script in there, too. And we sanitized that. We stripped out the script. And the way that we strip that out is by using a method called toStaticHTML. toStaticHTML takes a function. And so basically you say, hey, pass this through toStaticHTML, which rips out all the script. It's only HTML that's left over. And then use that and insert that. And so that's essentially what's happening under the covers. And so I wanted to make you guys aware of this, because you're going to be programming, and then you're going to go, I thought there was script here, and it got ripped out. What happened? And you're probably hitting this. And you'll get an exception in the debugger. And then you'll get lots of documentation, and it'll point you to the sample, and you'll read up on that again. So it's sort of showing what that looks like. The last thing here that I kind of wanted to show, and this is kind of a fun exercise, is just the exception handling behavior in apps in general. I don't know if you guys have tried this before. But basically, have you ever gone into IE and like enabled debugging? This is pretty fun. Like, everybody thinks that they write really clean, exception-free code until you try surfing the web with this option on and see how far you get. And so, like, I was just tinkering around this morning, and like, there's this tech meme site. I use this to get all my news. And let's see if I can get it to repro. And like, oh yeah, bang. So like, I went to one site, I click refresh, and bang, like, I already had some site with an unhandled JavaScript exception. And on the web, like, users don't see this, right? Because, number one, that option's not enabled. And two, like, they have a refresh button. And like, when things don't work right, you just F5. And like, if things still don't work right, you're like, damn IE, I'm gonna go get Chrome. And so you do that. Like, that's just the natural way the web works. Like, it's meant to be forgiving. And that's why, like, your web code, like, we're sloppy. Like, okay, yeah, I didn't have a closing bracket. The browser handled it, whatever. And like, but you need to think about it differently, because you're writing apps. And like, if you have an unhandled exception in your C++ app, bang, like, your app dies and goes away. And like, I want to show that behavior and just make sure that that's really clear to everybody what happens there, because your app will go away. So let me just close this and create a new project real quick. Sure, blank app, whatever. And let's do something like really, really basic. So we have a button. I'll add an onClick handler. And we'll call foo, because I know foo doesn't exist, with a nice click me. So here I am. I have this button. I know foo is not defined. When I click it, bang, I break into the debugger. You can see, hey, foo is undefined. Yes, thank you. but the other thing that you should note about this is that when you run your app from Visual Studio, the debugger gets attached. And so exceptions go to the debugger, and it's meant for debugging, developing apps, et cetera. But your app also gets installed directly. And you want that, because when you're debugging, JITting is turned off. So that way, like, your JavaScript runs slower. But that way, the JavaScript debugger can resolve the symbols and know what line you're at. With JITting turned on, like, the JavaScript debuggers can't do that. And so if you want to run your app with full perf, like, we created app 2, it's now installed. And so now it's running not under a debugger whatsoever. And when I hit that unhandled exception, like, my app just goes away. And so as web developers, we now need to think about writing better code. And so that's sort of the point behind my spiel. And so what does better code mean? Does it mean not having any exceptions? No, it definitely doesn't mean that. In fact, it's very common for you to use libraries and other things that throw tons of exceptions everywhere. And so we're not trying to solve that problem whatsoever. And so we have this behavior, though, that if code that you own, the stuff in the local context, if it throws exceptions, those need to be handled by you. And so if they bubble all the way up to on error and they were never handled, then your app goes away. And so you can either have an on error handler or just use a try catch block. Whether you choose to do anything with the error is up to you. You know whether the error is benign or whether or not you need to do something different. But wrap your code in try catch blocks. So the long story there. So I just kind of wanted to sum up what we just saw, because that was sort of a more complicated SDK sample. So here's some common things that you want to do. Sometimes you just want to load trusted content, stuff that you think is trusted. So you XHR, you go get it, and you want to insert it into your DOM. Like, keep in mind that we will strip out script. Yes, there's a fancy way around it, and it's in the documentation, et cetera, if you really know what you're doing. But really, by default, we try to keep you safe. We try to keep you from taking untrusted script from the web, putting it into your DOM, and then having it abuse the Windows runtime APIs. The second is, OK, what do I do if I have untrusted content? Just like the web today, use an iframe and just keep that isolated from your main app. And yes, we support like the sandbox attribute now on iframes. And so you can get even more granular with it. You could say, like, I want this iframe that doesn't have a script. And I want this one that does have script, and et cetera. And then there are times when it's most appropriate to delegate to the browser. And so as you saw in my examples, yeah, you can create an iframe and point it at foo.com. And like that could be a big portion of your app. You could totally do that. But we didn't give you the components that you would need in order to build a browser. So please don't try to build a browser. This is not a browser platform. It's an app platform. And so if you find that the bulk of the activity in your app is like showing existing websites unmodified, like chances are pretty good you should just be directing the user to the browser. And there's an API that allows them to launch the browser. So think about those things as you go to build your app. So we talked about those three sort of bulky things together, the packaging and the app model, about how local context, web context stuff, all the way through. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, this is, by the way, this is the fourth piece, the process lifecycle. Because you need to think about how your app runs now differently. When users go to websites today, like there's this process, right? You fire up a browser, HTTP colon, whatever your site name is, like some HTTP traffic happens, content gets downloaded, eventually your page loads and it usually trickles in. And we know all of these fancy tricks now to make pages load faster and still trickle in the background. And it's sort of natural in viewing websites. And then when the user's done with your website, they like close the browser or they nav to a different site and then you're done. But these are apps now. And so apps have a couple of different states. The first state, and the most obvious state, is that your app is running. And so what happened to get your app to running is that the user clicked on a tile, an instance of that host process was created, it loaded the code of your app, there was a splash screen that was happening, then the splash screen gets torn down, and now your app is presented to the user. And the user's expectation is that when the splash screen goes away, the app is usable, instantly usable, which is sort of different than websites, because again, they sort of trickle in. So mindset change, when the splash screen goes away, users better be able to use your app. When they switch away from your app, new behavior happens. In the browser today, it just keeps running. But we're not asking users to actively manage apps. That's why there's no close button. There are fancy close gestures and other ways. You can use Task Manager and still close apps, et cetera. But we're not asking regular users to do that. Instead, Windows manages your app lifecycle. And so when you switch away from an app, your app gets suspended by the operating system. It's akin to if you had broken into the native process in a debugger. It's like all CPU is like starved. Like you don't get any CPU time. But it's still resident in memory. And then as soon as we resume it, your app starts executing again. There's a state transition that happens between suspended. Sometimes the user switches back to your app and then things keep going. Sometimes, though, the app will get terminated. And the OS owns the process here. It owns the rules. And so if you're under low memory conditions, your app might get terminated. But the key to you as app developers is that you don't get notified between suspended and terminated. So the model looks like this. App's running, doing fine. User switches to the background. Bang, you get a suspend notification. That's your cue to do work. That's your cue to save off state. Because once you're suspended, you don't get notified again before you get terminated. You just get terminated. That's it. And so let's kind of look at that in action. It's probably clear if I show an app doing it. So here we are. There's an app. I'm going to go pull up the weather app. So here I am. It's surprisingly nice today. It's like 79. I know I have it in this. Sorry. I should change it. Better? OK. 20. It's 23 degrees, whatever 23. 79 to me. So here we are in this app. And if I switch away from the app and I go back, I'll close these, to the desktop, I'll pull up Task Manager. Kind of want to show some stuff. So here I am in Task Manager. Here's that weather app. And I can go to the Details pane. And I can scroll down, and I see this process called wwahost.exe. That is the host process. That's the execution environment of your app. Think of that. It's not Internet Explorer. It's not Chrome or whatever. It's wwahost. That's the thing that's powering your app, the thing that's loaded the web platform. And you can see that in the state of that, it shows a bunch of apps. There's a bunch of apps that are running. But this particular one is suspended, which makes sense because I switched away from the app. So when I switch away, the app gets a notification. It has 5 seconds to do work. And then after that, the OS will suspend it, whether it is done or not. So here we are. We have this suspended app. And if I go back to it, OK, it's exactly the same place. You can see it was instant, right? Like never out of memory, always stayed resident in memory. We just starved CPU execution, and now, bang, it's back. So let's say that I wanted to configure this app a little bit. So I'm going to change it, and I'm going to go back to Redmond. And I'd really like to see things in Fahrenheit, because that's what makes sense to me. It's not very nice in Redmond right now. And so then I'll switch away from the app again. And you can see it's running, 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 running. Still running. Still running. OK, suspended. Without even notifying the app anymore, pulling it back up, I'm just going to terminate it. And now going back to the app, note the splash screen animation when the app starts, OK? Because that. And then, hey, the app is back. And this is an example of where the app did not do the right thing. And so I want you guys to do the right thing, which is like, I switched. Like, my expectation is that the weather is in Redmond now. And so whether it's you have options for that, or know to save state along the way and checkpoint along the way, but do those particular things. And just, I know I was kind of using this to throw the Bing guys under the bus, but they actually do the right thing. But theirs is a little more hidden. And so I wanted to kind of show that right now. Like, they have the places. And you can choose Redmond. But also down here, they had a set as default value in case you were just looking around. But those are some of the design decisions that you need to think about when you're doing your app, about what users' expectations should be when they come back to your app, and whether or not you save state automatically, or whether or not you make the user choose a specific setting or value to say, like, no, I really meant this. Like, please preserve this particular property. So think about those things as you go through the design of your app. The other thing that I wanted to show real quick on the lifecycle piece is this notion of an extended splash screen. So when your app launches, you get a splash screen. And it's OS owned. You define this and the graphic for it in your apps package. Sometimes, though, that initial time for the splash screen is not long enough for you, and you need even more time. And so you can see an example of an app that does that. And so they say, where it said getting the store ready for you, that was their extended splash screen. And they get to put their own text there. And they do it in such a way that it looks seamless to the user. You didn't even know that a second splash screen came into play. There was the OS-owned one, and then there was an app-drawn one. And then when that disappeared, your app was fully ready. And I totally get, in an enterprise environment especially, like you're probably loading data from some database, and sometimes that database is really slow. And so in the browser, like users just wait and they see a thing forever, forever, forever. If your app doesn't activate within 15 seconds, Windows thinks your app is hung and it will terminate it. And so that's why you need to think about these things as a web developer. Like you need to think about how long your app would take to activate and whether or not to show an extended splash screen. And again, there's SDK samples for that particular piece. So we talked about all of those four sort of basic components. But now I wanted to just conclude by talking about a quick thing for line of business apps. At the beginning of the talk, I talked about the package manifest and that it had two purposes. One was for deployment, and that's where you like define the start page for your app and all those things. The other is for runtime. And so there's this notion that your app has of capabilities. Because your app does not run in the context of a user, it runs as something less than that. And so by default, your app has access to nothing. It has no internet access. It has no access to files that of the user. And so how do you get those things? You declare access for those in the manifest. You say, as a developer, I want to use those things. And so there are some capabilities that are very sort of enterprise focused, and I just wanted to call attention to those. Those include intranet capability versus internet. Another one around internet client server. So by default, like you could talk out, but you could not receive in HTTP. So if you needed that capability, or enterprise auth, like if you wanted access to the user's domain creds, so you could do single sign-on type things, you would do that and declare that in the manifest. Another thing is around security and privacy. One of the simplest things that you can do is there's a meta tag setting that will allow you to do HTTPS only connections if that's of concern to you. But I wanted to call particular attention to the roaming thing because you've probably heard a lot about this. We've talked about it in the press. We talked about it in some of the keynotes about, hey, we want this capability where you use an app on different devices and you get the same settings everywhere, and we have this notion of roaming. And that makes total sense for end users and their apps the majority of the time. But in some enterprise applications, like you may not want that data to ever roam. And so there are three different storage locations for app data. And one of them is specifically called roaming. So only put stuff in roaming if you want it to roam. It makes sense, right? And so just think about that, though, when you build your app. And then the last is offline capabilities. Like, it's very common to sort of be in this pseudo-connected state. Like, I remember my 10-hour flight out here. Like, I wasn't really connected, but I still wanted my apps to sort of work. And then when I came back online, I wanted them to sync. How would I do that? As web developers, we understand that there are new emerging standards that cover this, things like IndexedDB, things like AppCache. And of course, those things are available. There's also a whole set of Winrar runtime APIs that are available for that. And so just calling out that capability, if you wanted to build an app that also worked offline, those capabilities exist. And so just to kind of bring it all home, like I hope you guys believe like I believe that building a great Metro-style app, simple, fast, like you saw my copy-paste example, like I really didn't spend much time on that, and like we got pretty quickly an app up and running. And just like at the beginning where I kind of showed you like, please don't ever create this as a Metro app. I definitely don't want to see this in the store. But I would like to see stuff like the Bing Finance app, which is sort of this really, really immersive, content first, content over Chrome, great topography, great images that really immerses the user in this experience of, you know, figuring out where the DAO is going. And so I thank you guys for your time today. I'm around to answer questions up here on the stage afterwards. And there's some other great talks that I would recommend that sort of relate to this web development thing, and they're here. Thank you, guys.